everyone. Welcome. So, suing spyware in Europe, news from the front. As Felix said, I am the director of Data Rights. Data Rights has a scope that is the entirety of the EU, and we started being active in 2024. The goals of Data Rights are to help fight for an internet that is free from arms races and from monopolies that control our lives. Celia, over to you.
And I'm from Spain, I'm from Barcelona. I'm from an organization called Iridia, which is a Catalonia-based human rights association specialized on civic and political rights. And we combine direct support for those who experience rights violation with strategic litigation, psychosocial intervention, transformative communication, and political advocacy. And we work from an intersectional and a feminist approach, trying to reach and promote public policy change. So I'm going to start not explaining a lot more about the organization, because I'm going to explain a very specific case that we are currently litigating. But before jumping into the case, I think that I would like to explain you a bit the context. So let me take 30 seconds just to explain, to set the scene and explain the context, because in this case, the context matters. So it brings us to 2017 and 2021, Catalonia lived through an extraordinary moment of popular mobilization around the right to self-determination. It all came to the head of the 1st of October of 2017, that it was taken place the referendum for independence of Catalonia that the Spanish authorities declared as illegal. Many of you might remember like those pictures of many millions of protesters protecting the schools where the people were about to vote. But also you might remember the widespread police violence that was documented that day. At the end of the day, like few months after, it was declared the independence of Catalonia in the Parliament of Catalonia. It's important to be said that it was a very important moment. It took place in November 2017, but it was as much as important as quick, because it just lasts for 44 seconds. But we are proud of it. We have to explain it, you know, like we have to say it, 44 seconds. It was huge. But then the consequences, you know. What I'm going to explain here, it was also the consequences, because that moment, the consequences had last years and years and bring us today. So 12 political leaders, they were in prison on charges of rebellion and embezzlement, and they were facing sentence between 8 to 12 years. Their detention was repeatedly criticized as unfair by international human rights bodies. And although they were ultimately pardoned in 2021, the damage had already been done. So I'm going to set, once the context is set, I really would like to bring you to the 14 May 2020. We were finding ourselves in the middle of the pandemic, so the middle of the COVID lockdown, and an online meeting was held to coordinate the collective legal defense for the political prisoners. Maybe in their pajamas. So we're talking about the lawyers meeting online. And one of the lawyers in that meeting that was attending had his phone infected with Pegasus. He didn't know it at the time. It was his personal and professional device. And he is our colleague, Andreu, who is the person whose case we are bringing before the court today. It took 2 years for the Citizen Lab to uncover the truth. So 65 people in Catalonia had been surveilled using Pegasus and Candiru between 2017 to 2021. Findings later on were confirmed by Amnesty Security LAC. But also we discovered a year ago that the spying started in 2015, being Spain the second client of NSO Group, which I'm going to talk a bit later on. So those targets include human rights defenders, activists, computer science, family members of politicians, elected representatives of the Catalan and the European Parliament, and lawyers. Three lawyers. So Andreu, our colleague, and also a member of Iridia's board of directors, was spied on because of his work as an attorney. He was spied to gain access to confidential client information and to undermine the legal defense itself. The main suspect in here is the CNI, which is translated as the Spanish National Intelligence Center, that it operates as domestic and international intelligence agency, and all its activities are classified as secret under the Official Secret Act. And let me tell you that this law was signed by Franco in 1968, and it's still in force today. So officially, neither the CNI or the Spanish government have ever confirmed the surveillance. But just days after the Catalan was published, the director of the CNI back on the time was dismissed. Surprise. Also, it was shown to the leak to the press that confirmed that 18 of that group was spied with the authorization for the Supreme Court. But then, actually, yet, today, when you ask, the official answer remains the same. So nothing happened. So our colleague Andreu is one of those, these remaining 70, the 47 people who were spied with Pegasus without judicial authorization, which this means that they were spied illegally. At Iridia, we're trying to break down the case. We're trying to answer that question, to clarify what happened, to establish responsibility, and to ensure that these serious violations of human rights never happen again to anyone. So in May 2022, we filed a criminal complaint for unauthorized access to computer systems, illegal interception of communications, computer espionage, and the production and the use of a spyware, pointing the companies responsible for developing and exporting Pegasus, which is a company that you might know that it's NSO Group. Because we often, and rightly, we focus on a state responsibility. But from a tech perspective, we also need to look for those who build the systems, the actors who design and test and develop and export tools capable of taking disproportional and total control over a personal device. So going directly to NSO Group, which I found later on being an expert on for this case, it was found in 2010 to respond to what its three founders described as an European need. So Pegasus, the most known product they have, has evolved in alarming pace. But it's very important to say that it has been developing and being tested against Palestinians for many, many, many years before reaching Europe. So what initially required a user interaction, so a click to download, a link, now relies on a zero-click exploitation. That is the type that it was used against our colleague. It can access communication, extract data, and even manipulate the content on the device itself. So although NSO Group Technologies is formally a private company registered in Israel, NSO Group operates as an umbrella brand of a network of operational and financial companies spread across the world. So one of the most important hubs that NSO has is found in Luxembourg. So it was described by the European Parliament itself as NSO Group operational gateway into Europe. Today, the group has at least 19 registered companies, many of which share not only the same corporate purpose, but also the same office in the same number, the specifically same building in Luxembourg. So with this, within this structure that we are seeing, we decide to focus in two specific companies because they were the ones more linked to cybersecurity and spyware activities, but also because they were the first ones that were registered in Luxembourg back in 2014. I'm talking about OSI Technologies and QCyber Technologies. When we look closely to those companies, we found that these companies were directly connected to NSO Group in Israel with direct and structural ties. So much that between 2019 to 2020, they shared the same board of directors. So Henri Lavie and Shalef Julio, two of NSO founders, has a direct, a prominent role in those companies as well. So our goal here was to demonstrate a technical and corporate chain of responsibility. But what we found investigating them was stronger than expected. So a similar governance structure repeated over the time with the same individuals at the center. That's why we decided to do this corporate report that we filed into the case last year to request the indictment of those who play the most prominent role across the three companies, NSO Group in Israel, OSI Technologies, and QCyber Technologies in Luxembourg. So a few months after, a judge, not the judge that is investigating the case in Barcelona, but the judge for the Court of Appeal, accepted our request. And this makes the case a global first. A first criminal investigation anywhere in the world where NSO directors are being investigated in connection with the target of a Pegasus victim. And that matters, that it sets a precedent, because it opens the door for others who were spied by this kind of technologies, with the same kind of spyware, to pursue not only the states, but also the companies and the individuals who design and operate this system. In short, it begins to crack what had long been along a wall of impunity. Maybe I'm a bit ambitious here, but... because we are sure that their decision-making power in Luxembourg creates personal liability to them. And importantly, it's very important to say that these companies are not only merely responsible for selling the software. Their role goes much further. So the evidence shows involvement in technical and support services. So in the deployment and the installation of the spyware, the monitoring of the use, and they provide ongoing operational support. In other words, what we're talking here is not a passive distribution, it's an active participation that the company has on the spying. So at this point, you will be wondering why they go so deep and why these people keep digging. And the answer is, it's quite simple and it's very sad at the same time, because the burden of the investigation in Spain has fallen almost entirely in the defense on us. And we are determined to get to the bottom of this, to achieve justice. Because you look around and the reality is striking. It's quite depressing, actually. The judge is not specialized in high technical and technological cases and has shown little willingness to actively investigate. 3 years and 7 months have passed and ongoing. We're counting and counting and counting. And meanwhile, we operate under a legal framework that allows disproportionate and unchecked use of spyware. Because in Spain, the deployment of this technology by intelligence agency service is regulated by a single article that is written 5 lines long in a law governing judicial oversight of the CNI. So targets are never notified. Judicial oversight is theoretical, but not always. And there is not effective right to access to personal data or the surveillance records. So the public prosecutor constantly opposes the investigation. Israel remains silent, the company remains silent. So it's very encouraging environment to keep going, right? But despite having submitted extensive evidence showing the urgency and the necessity of investigating these practices now, one fundamental risk remains today in place, that there is no mechanism in Spain to determine today whether spyware is currently being used and against whom. So here we are, fighting to investigate the past, legally forbidden from discussing or addressing the present, or preparing for the future. And all of this is happening while mercenary surveillance tools, spyware, and the companies to produce them continue to grow, to expand, to operate without meaningful regulation or accountability. So, and yes, it's not a way to speak. What we're seeing today is that NSO Group is describing themselves today after going through a reputational crisis, but these companies are actively rebuilding. They are rebranding under American... I forgot the slide. Sorry very much. I was like, uh-oh. Are rebranding under American names and investors, and they're moving into larger offices in Israel. They're presenting themselves as renewed and stronger than before. And although, for the first time in years, NSO founders, they're not longer officially part of the companies. They have certainly not left the market. On the contrary, they continue to thrive in surveillance and security ecosystems through new venues. Same expertise, same branding. So we're seeing that with Shalev Hulya News Company, Dream Security. So the conversation has to be taken now. That's why we are here, to really address the topic and start building a strategy to combat against it.
Thank you so much, Celia. That's what we love about Spaniards. They're really passionate. Let's take a step back and zoom out. So this was Spain. Now, the reality is that Spain was not the only country in Europe that was messing up. So let's go back in time in 2019. So after the scandal of Amnesty and Forbidden Stories and then Citizen Lab, the European Parliament thought, okay, let's do a serious investigation here, because there's a pattern of countries that seem to have messed up. And so that investigation started in 2019 and was ended in 2024. They came up with very strong recommendations, very inspiring recommendations, and then nothing, as the Brits would say, not even a sausage, which is not massively inspiring. So this is actually the same year that I met Celia's colleague, Andrew, and he was telling me, hey, there's nothing happening. The political will is completely dead. And we're a bunch of people across Europe working on these cases, but we're actually not speaking with each other. We should probably get together. And I thought, yeah, that sounds reasonable. And he said, hey, let's do it together. Oh, whoa, this is crazy. But yeah, actually, I'm in. So now we have launched this summer a coalition of organizations throughout Europe that are putting resources together to really help another and figure out how to be the most strategic around cases. So really the strategy here, so the core goal is litigation. So that means going to court or to regulators with complaints. And yeah, so we're really taking, you know, the cases from the ground up, basically. You know, you have local cases with the experiences of the targets, and then you build on this. And of course, the goal is to reach European courts, because the ultimate goal is to get precedence for the entirety of Europeans. The beauty of this coalition is that it gets us to be very strategic about cases. So yeah, we can focus on cases that we find the most interesting. And so when we launched the coalition in the EDRI offices last summer, we also had the lead of the European Parliament's investigation that was there to launch with us. And actually, during the launch, she even said that from her perspective, her political perspective, litigation was the only way forward from now on. So this is very inspiring. And so we're going to take the opportunity to tell you about two other countries, Hungary and Poland. So in Hungary, there were seven targeted people that reached the Hungarian Civil Liberties Union and got support from that organization. It's interesting to know that most of these people are journalists. Most of these journalists are specialized in investigating anti-corruption. So there's a pattern that we see, but I'm going to go back on this. Three cases are now before the Constitutional Court. We are hoping to get a ruling by the Constitutional Court next year, but do not hold your breath, because that court is clearly under the influence of Orbán and the Fidesz. So, but the goal is really to have a ruling and then, yeah, again, get to the European level where we can actually push for change. Maybe something worth mentioning, they all went to the Data Protection Authority of Hungary, and that authority said, as far as they were concerned, it looked amazing, so very inspiring. And now Poland. So Poland is very interesting because, like Spain, the context plays a lot. So a few years ago, there was a coalition of far-right parties that was leading the country. And at some point, there were some local elections, and one of the coalition parties decided to hire, to use Pegasus to throw on their coalition friends, which is lovely, but also on many other people, including a politician that was campaigning for his own party. And so this this man's name is Breja. I wrote it at the bottom so that, Polish names. And so... And what happened to this man is very interesting because they used Pegasus to infect his phone, and they extracted 10 years of texts. So just to pause for a second here, you know, usually when we think about surveillance, we think real-time interception, and we're already quite shocked. This is 10 years. This is insane. And so not only that, but so they took 10 years of texts, and then what they did, law enforcement, they rearranged the texts. They actually merged some texts to build a completely new narrative. And then they sent this to the media, probably media that they owned. And then that was presented on Polish TV. So this man had his texts completely rearranged, building a new narrative on Polish TV during elections. So this is really shocking in itself. And but also what makes Poland very interesting is that since then it has had a change of power. And so from a legal perspective, that's where it gets fascinating, because there has actually been an investigation, and the Polish state has found that indeed they had used Pegasus, which you realize with the Spanish case is quite an improvement already. And they even concluded that it had been used illegally, which again is very useful. Something also to mention, because unlike Spain, actually some judges were part of the authorization of Pegasus, and some European officials spoke with some of these judges, basically probably saying, hey, what the fuck? And the judges said, to be honest, I had no idea that I was allowing something so horrible. So the technical realities were completely misrepresented to me. This is horrible. So this is also something quite interesting. So as you realize now, there are some patterns across these cases, which is also why we like to be united, because we start to see these patterns. And so I'm not going to talk too much about the first point because you got it. Some of the patterns are, well, clearly primary targets are these people that have very protected, historically protected professions because they are safeguards in democracies. So lawyers and journalists, particularly investigative journalists working on anti-corruption, which is very interesting because, yeah, they are counterpowers, and I guess we're seeing more and more this expression rise, which I really like, which is spyware really feels like authoritarianism as a service. And just so you know, I rechecked the definition of authoritarianism. And so yeah, the key features are you're destroying the separation of powers, the free press, the rule of law, and basic freedoms. Okay, second pattern, no notification. So this is a very interesting one, actually, because in 2020, a bunch of some of the people that created Data Rights, we were involved with a case in France where we were suing the intelligence services. So we reached the top EU court, and we actually got something that has been asked around the globe for many years. So we got this for Europe. So after secret surveillance, when you're no longer considered a threat, you have to be notified. So it's interesting because that made it possible for us to then have conversations. And yeah, typically in Hungary or in Spain, the surveillance ended after that ruling in 2020. So people should have been notified, and that never happened, which is very interesting to stress out, because that completely prevents people from actually being aware that maybe they want to check whether their rights were protected in the first place. So a fundamental safeguard as a citizen of a democracy. And this is where also Celia is going to share some of their experience.
Yeah, I was just about to say very quickly, because you can imagine, like, in cases that the person was never notified. So in the any of, like, the group of the 65 people in Spain, none of them were notified. So some of them, they're not even recognized by this list published in the press of these 18 that had authorization by the Supreme Court. So we have these remaining 47 people that they have been never notified. They have been no spy illegally, like legally speaking, so they don't have any avenue to seek for an effective remedy. They don't have any remedy and any way to report, to speak up, to try to put in place the safeguard that they need in their devices, but also to fight back and to ask what happened, which kind of information do you have, where do you have it? I mean, there is many questions that those people still have it today from the moment that they were notified by the Citizen Lab that their phone was infected. So that even aggravates the situation with this no notification, but also not any willing to accept any responsibility from states.
And so now we're touching on the third point in terms of evidence, and actually this is where Iridia's experience is also useful.
Yeah, because I think that in all the situation that I already explained, and also with all these patterns that, like Lori deep in, imagine the situation. So we found ourselves that your phone was hacked. It was confirmed, it was tested by the Citizen Lab. It was confirmed by the Citizen Lab. It was confirmed by Amnesty Security Lab. But the judge in Spain refused it to accept it as a forensic analysis. So then the judge is asking you, and they're asking the targets, to force to pay another forensic analysis to another company specialized on this. So it has an independent forensic analysis that could be filed in the case. So we did that. So most of the targets decide to pay another exam. And the answer confirmed that the phones were spied with Pegasus. But again, the judge and the prosecutor, the public prosecutor in Spain, rejected as evidence. So what is really happening right now in Spain? That the judge is asking the targets, the people that got affected by Pegasus, to give their phones to the police so the police can test it. So, you know, and it's like, how is this going to happen? And you know, few people gave their phones to the police. And what the police said, that the phones was infected with Pegasus. But it's kind of like how many we have to take, no? But it's very important to say that, because I think it's just to highlight it, the impact that this technology has in people's life, in their work life. I mean, for journalists, for lawyers, who has a confidentiality, not the secret right for the clients. I mean, it really breaks their profession. But it's very important to say that from a technical point of view, from a legal point of view, but from a human point of view, it's not investigation. That is really re-victimization for those that have been experienced that, and they have to go again and again and again, like bringing their phones now to the police. So few of them rejected that, but the others, as said, give it to them, and the police accepted they were infected.
And so just to say, this is a general pattern across countries. And, you know, this brings us back to the second point. You know, if the notification had been done by the states, we would not be reaching this point where, you know, individuals are getting notifications wherever they can get them. So be it companies, being a research lab in Canada, and then, yeah, the judges are very often saying this is not hard evidence. So there's no winning here. This confused me. And yeah, of course, how acceptable is this that we depend on US companies and a research lab in Canada to be able to use our fundamental rights? All right, so on that note, I decided that we would have a sanity break, and when Celia saw my sanity break, she created a sanity break over it. So this is the first sanity break, the meta one. And then I just wanted to pause for a second and say, you know, there are some very great things legally around here. We have rulings in Europe that are very strong. You know, secret surveillance for the protection of national security can end up destroying democracy under the cloak of defending it. So, you know, when you read things like this in law school, you're like, well, this is clearly some legal badassery going on. It's going to be great. And then, you know, you hit the ground and this is actually what it looks like. And yeah, it's slightly underwhelming. But anyways, so in terms of the long-term stakes, Your cybersecurity aware crowd, so we're not going to talk too much about it, but of course, stockpiling hacking tools, what could go wrong? This is a disaster, and WannaCry showed it, because you turn into a honeypot if you're sitting on a pile of 0 days. And yeah, WannaCry was stolen, I mean, the tools in there were stolen and then launched on the public. It hit critical infrastructure, hospitals, disaster. The only way around this is vulnerability management, and I really wanted to mention this non-binding opinion of the Constitutional Court of Germany a few years ago that highlighted not only that IT is so important now in people's life, that it has to be intertwined to the ability for people to enjoy their basic rights. So that's already fundamental. And then, yeah, if you're not capable of doing it well, then no spyware for you, pretty simple. And then a second point, so there is the need to really have serious conversations around capabilities, because when, not here, but clearly if you're in Brussels, when you talk about spyware, a lot of people will say, oh, that's just a new surveillance tool, that's just a new toy of law enforcement. Yeah, but it's not. It's zero days. So zero days can do all sorts of things, not just spying. And there needs to be a real reality check here, especially because, you know, normal market dynamics, if you want all the shares of the market, you need to have the most powerful zero days. What are going to be the most powerful zero days? Well, the ones that give admin control. And if you have admin control, then you have your hand over data integrity, so you can add, you can remove, you can modify data. And we're getting in that way. The Polish example is kind of getting in that way, but to be fair, they were going for a smear campaign, so they didn't actually look, they didn't need to modify the data on the phone of Breja. The Indian case is really interesting. So in 2018, what the police did, they partnered with hackers, and they're going after activists, and they got the hackers to infect with Pegasus, and then inject with another tool the computers of activists. They injected fake evidence, and then surprise, surprise, the police raided the activists the day after, used that evidence, and sent the activists to jail. So this is really powerful to realize, because this is actually what is at stake with spyware. Right, and on this note, we are reaching the end of this talk. Maybe something quite reassuring to think about, because this is not really something that people realize in our circles, but here definitely, you know, what's the bottom issue also here? The bottom issue is that we have highly monopolistic environments. We have basically, for the general public, two operating systems. So, you know, if you want to be a strong actor in this market, you have to figure out how to hack into those. But what if we had a more diversified environment? It would be much more expensive to develop spyware. And so this is really a thought that I want to leave you with. And then also, this is of course the opportunity for us to widen a little bit the scope of the conversation and to highlight the fact that here we're talking about spyware, but spyware is actually falling into the category of dual-use technologies. So I put the definition here. It's technologies that have very potent military and civil use. And so, yeah, other examples are AI, satellite imagery, biometrics. Biometrics is a very good example, for example, because the cameras that will be used for you to go through the airport are exactly the same that will have been trained in China, as reported by the New York Times, to recognize the ethnic origins of individuals that were Muslims, so that there would be signals sent to the police if you have a Muslim that enters a certain area in a city. So these are technologies that are incredibly powerful, and states are very reluctant to build safeguards because, yeah, they have an edge. And so this is really a conversation that we're trying to develop, to go in that space, to not be completely tied to the technology, to be a bit technology neutral, to be able to not be reactive and to adapt to future conversations, because we're actually a little bit surprised that at the moment there's no more conversations about the coupling of these technologies. And you know, we're hearing new rumors about AI and spyware, and we're looking for money to actually look into this. But also, what about biometrics and AI? You know, so this is really something that we also want to lean towards, to adapt to future conversations and challenges. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Lori and Celia. Very important and impactful work. We have a bit of time for Q&A, so if you have a question, please make your way to one of the microphones throughout the room. And you also have the possibility to ask questions through Matrix or IRC. And if you're leaving the room, please do so quietly so we can continue with the Q&A. And we start at microphone number one, please.
Hello. Thanks for the talk. It was very interesting. My question is about the public discourse. Like, the public discourse is shaped by the media very much into the we only use spyware to fight terrorists, and it's very shaped around, oh, we wouldn't abuse it, even though there's clearly abuse. Would you say this public discourse and how it's shaped and often portrayed hinders you in your investigations? Because people are like, why are you investigating? It's used against terrorists. Oh, there's one misuse. Would you say this affects your investigations and also the public opinion against you?
Maybe just if I start. So it's actually a conversation that we had, because that's also what is really strong in talking and working together, because we realized that the context is very different from one country to another. And so typically in the Spanish example, the public was actually led to think that it was spyware were great because it was enabling to go after separatists. So you absolutely need to hone to the national context of the conversation, and then maybe if you want to.
Yeah, and I think that what we have been trying to do, because since we are finding ourselves a bit isolated and quite lost, so it's actually the organization that we are going to, I'm litigating in these cases, that we are adding more information to really break down these kind of narratives that have been built by the media. And I think that what we're seeing is, like, as we speak, I mean, 3 years had passed, so I mean, it's a lot. So we had the opportunity a lot also to work with journalists to explain what is really happening, to present our reports, to show the evidence. I mean, forensically speaking, on the companies, on the state responsibility aspect, I mean, we have everything in our favor. I mean, the information is there. So I think it's we're experiencing how it changed, but it's very much difficult for people to understand the impacts of a spyware, because they think that it's something that is happening to some politicians, that they were doing things back on the time. And we are trying to break this down, because it, right now, as an environment that we are living today, it could happen to any of us. And we wouldn't know about it. So we're trying to create all this alert to be prepared. So we are trying to create this case to create a precedent for others, so everyone could be notified, everyone would be able to have information about it, and everyone would have the access to remedies to fight against it. So we're trying to break this down, even though it's very much complicated, because the National Intelligence Service calls the press, and we have the very nice highlights, but we're trying to create others that could create the counterbalance on that sense.
Microphone number three for the next question, please.
Oh, thank you for your talk. How easy is it, if the national courts are not taking you seriously or are actively blocking you, to go to a higher court like the European one? And do the countries accept the rulings of the European courts?
I mean, we have to exhaust all the domestic avenues. So right now, I didn't say it, but we are like 3 years past, and we are finding on the preliminary investigation on the case. So it's in the judge in Catalonia, in Barcelona, that is investigating. But we have to go up, we have to exhaust all the avenues. So to go to the constitutional one, and then, I mean, first of all, to appeal, to go to the court to appeal, and then go to the Supreme Court. And then when we get full denial for, like, the investigation to take place, then we can go up to the European Court of Human Rights. And then I think that what is really important, and maybe we can also add it here, like, we are seeing that other cases on spyware and Pegasus are reaching the European Court of Human Rights, that could create a precedent for others, that we are in our way, because we really believe that we are not going to find justice in Spain, as we have been seeing. I mean, it's quite clear, because we have all the obstacles that undermines the investigation. Even the public prosecutor who had to support and protect the victims is all the time repeatedly asking for the closure and the completely opposing to the investigation to take place. So while we're finding evidence, the public prosecutor is saying, they're not valid. Mm-hmm. Just close this. It's they're too, you know, they have been talking for so many time. So I think that we are really wishing to arrive to the European Court for Human Rights, because we think it's the open opportunity for us to get some justice, to get some remedies and reparation for the victims, for the people who were targeted, but also to create a precedent for others and don't have to go all all the way up again, since we're experiencing that way.
Maybe you comment on this, because also, you know, typically the Hungarians, they're not doing this because they think their country is going to think, oh my God, I have seen the light. No, but they're doing this for the rest of Europeans. They're doing this, and this is the reason why we're doing this. We're trying to not care too much about states. We're trying to think in terms of, like, how do we protect as a group? And so, yeah, this is, I guess, our guide tonight.
Thank you.
Microphone number one for the next question, please.
Yes, hello, Andreas Dietschi, a lawyer in Switzerland. So we saw a lot of cases. Switzerland wasn't mentioned, so probably there is no process going on there, although, like, at least one Spanish activist was, like, infected still when she was in Switzerland. And there was quite some infrastructure in Switzerland of Pegasus as well. So, and we have all those different countries and cases and stuff. So my question is a little bit, how can we do, like, mutual assistance and mutual legal assistance at state level? I mean, it could be that some in some countries, states are more willing to, like, seize a server, for example, in Switzerland. Probably Switzerland wouldn't do that, but maybe when there are two countries which are more privacy or human rights friendly, that they could, like, that there one could use state support as well. How do you see that? And, like, how is there a possibility of, like, legal professionals on the legal professionals level, how one can support one internationally? And then as well, how do you see, like, hacktivist level, how hacktivists could support in such cases?
I'm sure you have things to say, but maybe some thoughts. So it's a difficult topic. So it's not like you just have someone random coming to you and say, hey, I can help on that topic, and you'll be like, yeah, sure, I'll trust you. So there's that reality. Now, in terms of using states to help us, it's a cat and mouse game that we're playing at the moment, because we're working with investigative journalists, researchers, and of course that's the, you know, that's also the problem when states are relying on mercenary for profits, because they can just disappear very quickly. So we're also trying to be very strategic about that. And then, of course, you guys are working also on that. So
yeah, no, for us, I mean, that we are really trying to, I mean, to create a network that goes beyond to the state, because mainly the state is the one responsible for that. I mean, and we are fighting directly the state. But I think that that's what is really important, to start creating groups, I mean, to create this conversation and to start why we create the PEGA Coalition. It was a way to open the conversation, to share strategies, because, I mean, it's like we want to break this isolation that we're finding ourselves trying to bring cases into court, but while we are doing it ourselves alone. So as Lori was saying, we are doing that to create a common strategy that could be used. So if we open the way to go against the companies, that others in Hungary can you do it if they want it? I mean, we have the information. We did that in order to support other cases as well. So I think the way to start overcoming this situation, it comes from this kind of multi-space that it's from researchers, journalists, legal, attorneys, advocacy officers, many activists as well. So to create a space that we can build a conversation that could really create another narrative, as we were saying with the other question, because what we're seeing is states are completely closing themselves. I mean, they don't really want to be part on these conversations, because they're the ones who use it against journalists, lawyers, activists. So that's why we have to create an alternative space. That's what we're trying to propose here as well. So I think that for anyone who would like to add information or to know more, they can read us. I mean, we can continue the conversation then. But I think that more research, as Lori was saying, we need to trying to understand what is really happening today, because we are fighting cases that goes back to 2020, and we are in 2025. Almost finishing it. So it's kind of like, what is really happening today? To be able to not be always late on fighting these cases, to be in a situation that we can know what is really happening today, which are the tools that they are used, which kind of technologies that they are mixed and used against us. And from an activist point of view, I think that because people are more aware of it, I mean, I think that people start creating coping strategies on how they protect their phones, how to use like more protecting networks. I think that it's a conversation that I'm an activist myself, and these conversations are already taking place in our meetings. So I think that it's while we cannot detect it, we have to also be able to protect more ourselves in that sense.
Maybe actually to build on this, I realize if useful, there is definitely something that we need, which is a better, more granular understanding of the data lifecycle. This is something that I'm going to, the Citizen Lab, and I'm begging them, please give me more details. And this is conversations that we're having because they're like, well, we absolutely are ready to explain some things to you, but we're not going to give you anything in writing because we don't want to threaten our research methods that could be used by the companies. So this is also where we're kind of between the tree and the bark. So this is something that we really need, a better understanding of the data lifecycle. And actually, to also build upon your question, this is also the reason why we created the coalition, so that we can cross-pollinate in terms of the legal arguments. And we realized that we needed to have more cybersecurity and data protection arguments, for example. So I'm working on it at the moment.
We have a lot of questions, so please keep your questions brief so we can get to all of them. Microphone number 4 in the back, please.
Thank you both for your important work and the talk. My question is about the obligation to notify. I believe that was enacted in 2020, if I remember correctly. And my question is, even if it isn't practiced perfectly, do you know whether that also exists within retained or assimilated law in the United Kingdom?
So this was not a law. This was a ruling that we got. So that's different because you guys were already kind of out. so that's, I would say, nope. Actually, the UK, actually, that's really interesting because when we reached the top court of the EU, we were joined by Privacy International that were working on the UK aspect. And actually, some of us represented Privacy International in the court case. So we were all working on data retention. So actually, I'm wrong. This should be working also in the UK, even though it was post-Brexit, because the case has started before. You said something not working perfectly. Just a point on this, because it sounds like we're really, pointing fingers. We are. But
all but, the time.
But we mentioned Spain and Hungary about this. But I actually, thank you so much, because you're giving me the opportunity to say, no countries are following it. In the Netherlands, that was already existing, and people laugh when I mention this because they're like, oh yeah, we have a saying for this, right? Which is, the right to information that you'll never get. it's an absolute failure everywhere. The UK as well, would you imagine?
Thank you.
We have a question from the internet.
Yes, what laws or controls should be put in place to try to limit the impact of these tools?
Vulnerability management laws. That's definitely the start. And then, of course, we're working on exactly what we want to put as a message out there. Because the reality is that in the last years, we feel that in Brussels there's been it's been a bit chaotic. So politicians are kind of always passing a law. Oh, a new problem, let's just pass a new law. That makes it very complicated to actually know what are the principles that everyone needs to follow. So we're really at the moment having a lot of strategic conversations within the coalition. Do we actually want to call for some aspects to be regulated, or do we just want to call for the freak show to come to a halt? And actually we're coming more and more towards, aside from vulnerability management, we're thinking more and more about, actually, most of the safeguards already exist. If you did follow the law, that would already be quite a relief.
That's excellent advice. Microphone number 1, please.
Hi, thank you for your talk and your work. In the Netherlands, we have a thing called the Toetsingscommissie Inzet Bevoegdheden, which is the oversight committee that sees over surveillance and stuff. In 2022, the law has changed so that instead of getting permission before spying on someone, it's an after action review, which is kind of a slippery slope. I was wondering, as a concerned citizen, what can I do to prevent our government from even going further down that slope?
You're taking quite a task on your shoulders. So doing requests for information is already a good start. And I mean, I did a talk last year at the CCC about Frank van der Linde, his fight against the police, which is crazy. So you might want to follow his path. You can even reach him. He will be delighted. It's already, yeah, it's always a good start because, I mean, when people are asking for accountability from oversight bodies, we did this in France with the leader, actually, of the European Parliament's investigation, and that was a disaster. So, you know, it's already giving resources for people like us to then help and see, okay, is there something that we can build on here to then, yeah, try to reach higher courts and get a precedent.
For the next question, microphone number 3, please.
Hi, my name is Dominik Koschek, and thanks for the talk. It was really great and interesting. My question was, for the long-term stake or for the long-term goal, cybersecurity, Germany, for example, uses tools like Sentinel-1 to detect malware and co. with the help of AI. Horrible in my, for me. However, this approach can conflict with certain GDPR or DSGVO requirements, since data may be transferred to the USA and with the current government, that could, of course, be a problem. My question was, given these challenges, how can we still achieve long-term goals in cybersecurity because of shifting the, how would I say that, like the program to be secure to another country with these? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And you're very lucky because it turns out there's someone from GFF in the room, so I am sure they're listening absolutely what you're saying. So first of all, in the case that you described, it would not be the GDPR that applies. It would be the data, I've lost the name, law enforcement directive. And that directive is an absolute disaster, so definitely not starting on the wrong foot, on the right foot here. The fact that there are transfers with the US is definitely something interesting, because when we're talking about critical data, there's definitely some conversations to have. That being said, I guess this is a really interesting time to have these conversations, because typically Denmark, they've always had agreements with the US, and now their intelligence services are starting to say, it's a bit awkward now. So I guess this is the right time, but it's a hard one. Honestly, I think GFF is your best port of call here.
Okay, thanks a lot.
If there are burning questions, please make your way to the microphone now or post in the chat. We have one at microphone 1.
Thanks for the talk. I was wondering, I felt that you were dealing really well with the consequences of this problem, but is there any organization, coalition dealing with the root causes, which I think are the import of these technologies from places like Israel, from places like the US? Let's say maybe Hungary will start importing things from Russia, China, who knows? Maybe from my perspective, maybe it's time to close the door and say on a European level, this shouldn't happen. I know that it can lead, because I've heard discussions about this, it can lead to perversities like saying, oh, we need a European Palantir, which I don't think we need, but I'm sure these technologies are still going to be somehow manufactured, but maybe by closing this way of getting in, it might be useful to deal with some of the.
So this is a question that would deserve an entire talk. Just to be clear, this is the reason why we have this slide, because dual use is the wording of the regulation that touches on these exports. So you mentioned Israel. This is also a conversation that we have, but I'm not going to go into details here because this is kind of strategic. But yeah, of course, we're having these conversations. And of course, we're angry. But maybe just another word on exports controls, because this is a can of worms. Because typically researchers that we spoke with on the topic of the dual use regulation that is supposed to regulate exports, in January were telling us that actually these rules at the moment are such a disaster that they actually make it easier to share surveillance technology without any sort of accountability within Europe. And then in terms of bypassing them, it's extremely easy. So a lot of Europeans are now, you just travel with a server and then a bit of the code, I guess, in another server, you travel separately, boom. So there are huge problems about this. And to be honest, if I may, I think this is exactly the type of conversations where we really need people from the crowd of the CCC, because it feels quite lonely in these spaces where you're talking about capabilities and you say, for example, you know, unfortunately, I could talk about this for hours, so maybe...
I was just about to say very quick on this, like, because I think that it, in the case of NSO, what happens is like they move very quickly. I mean, they're spread around the world, but they're the most the place that the country that they're like have more companies registered is in Luxembourg. And like in early 2019, they were presenting themselves. The group was presenting themselves as an European network. So also that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to change their image. They're really trying to reshape their own image, their narrative, to be able to operate in less regulation in terms of the exportations. I mean, they're doing that. So we're finding ourselves that also the type of technology that they developed back on the time, now it's also European companies that they are developing it. I mean, now it's not a way back. So that's why also this conversation happened to take place right now. And also, I would really like to add, because I think that all of us, we understand that it's an European problem. It has been happening all around European countries. But also we don't have to forget that it's also an international problem. It has been happening all around. And the most affected people that has been affected by these technologies has been the population that has been tested against. So in the case of NSO Group, we're talking about Palestinians that they have been subjected to this kind of technologies and surveillance for many, 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 many years before it was exported around and spread around the world. So I think also we don't have to forget that, because in a way that we are fighting this, we're fighting at the European level because we have the mechanisms and all the tools to do it, but we don't forget the international aspect that connects us with the Colombians, that they are fighting and they're doing an amazing job against NSO as well. Or for example, the amazing rule that was in a court in California against NSO Group, and that it was WhatsApp against NSO Group. So we are taking all this perspective and international matter also to a way to address it. So I think it's important to be said.
And maybe just in case useful, actually, in terms of laws on imports, there should be the start of a reform on exactly that topic in Europe next year. And so we will definitely be following that or maybe getting involved. We'll see.
Okay, unfortunately, we're out of time, but where can people find you if they have more questions throughout the next days?
On the internet.
On the internet, or here at Congress?
or at the House of Tea.
At the House of Tea. That's